The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today's program is underwritten by the law firm of W.G. Alexander & Associates. Alexander attorneys provide top-rated and experienced legal counsel, concentrating on estate planning, elder law, special needs, and asset protection. Call W.G. Alexander & Associates at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the February 18th, 2022 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows a professional football stadium. Coach Brian Flores is blowing the whistle, and he's throwing a yellow referee's flag onto the ground. Behind him, NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell has a despairing look on his face and one hand covering his face. The headline is the NFL racist? Brian Flores blows the whistle on the league's dearth of black coaches. And we had that in our controversy of the week. We'll start today's show with the editor's letter. Once years ago, in the first flush of internet hope, a writer I knew was asked, these were heady times, if Silicon Valley would be the center of the universe for all the foreseeable future. Athens fell, the writer Alan Deutschman said, without missing a beat, and Rome fell, and Palo Alto will fall too. The line came back to me this week as the stock price of Meta, Facebook's parent, did an unprecedented nosedive. Is this the end of Facebook? I don't think so. I suspect that Facebook's namesake Blue App will fade, while Instagram will recover from the stumble. There is a good chance that Meta will recover in some way, though I would guess the way forward will not be through Mark Zuckerberg's beloved Metaverse, which has all the hallmarks of a very rich man's folly. In any case, the marketplace seems to be giving Facebook the comeuppance that so many advocates, activists, and lawmakers have wished for but could not dole out themselves. But is this the end of the Facebook age? That is a question that is bigger than Facebook. There's no hard and fast definition here, but we all know what the Facebook age is. Its central hallmark is rapid, algorithmically driven dispersal of content, which gives preference to the vapid and the polarizing. The Facebook age is not just Facebook. It is Twitter and TikTok and a million more imitators waiting in the wings. And it is our id. The algorithms bring to the fore what no one wants to admit to searching for. The Facebook age is the vicious cycle of ideas shaken and stirred by online mobs, then often laundered by the media, and then injected back into social media to repeat the cycle. There is no sign that this will wane. Facebook itself might take a drubbing at Apple's hands, but the Facebook age is bigger than Facebook or Meta or Zuckerberg, and we will be stuck in it for a long time to come. That was from Mark Gemmeim, managing editor. And we'll read two short main stories. Biden threatens Russian pipeline. What happened? President Biden this week vowed to block the Nord Stream 2, a key natural gas pipeline from Russia to Germany, if Russian troops cross Ukraine's border. White House officials warned that Russia already has in place 70% of the forces and equipment necessary for a mid-February invasion over the frozen marshland along Ukraine's border. Those forces, officials told Congress, could overtake Kyiv within 48 hours in a bloody bombardment that could kill up to 50,000 civilians and send millions of refugees surging into Poland. Biden's announcement that an invasion would trigger a shutdown of the just-completed $11 billion, 764-mile pipeline followed a meeting with German Chancellor Olaf Scholz. But while Scholz said NATO would be united on sanctions, he stopped short of committing to halting the pipeline. French President Emmanuel Macron headed to Moscow to try to persuade Russian President Vladimir Putin to de-escalate. Macron proposed reviving the Minsk Agreement, a framework drawn up during the 2015 Russia-backed insurgency in eastern Ukraine. That plan, though, allows autonomy for Ukraine's east, which could mean de facto Kremlin control. Putin, meanwhile, warned that a NATO war with Russia, one of the world's leading nuclear powers, would result in mutual devastation and no winners. Most European allies believe Putin will not invade. "I don't think anybody knows but him," said Biden. U.S. civilians are now advised to leave Ukraine because an invasion, National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said, could happen at any time. What the columnist said. "Biden, a child of the Cold War, is finally showing some backbone with Russia," said Holman Jenkins Jr. in the Wall Street Journal. "He is sending military supplies to Ukraine and troops to Poland while whipping a German chancellor into line. 1,000 more NATO troops will land in Romania soon, all to make Putin realize he can't afford the risk of invading." "Don't underestimate what Putin's willing to risk," said Anne Applebaum in The Atlantic. An imperial nostalgist with raw memories of when the Berlin Wall crumbled, leaving him and fellow Dresden-based KGB operatives frantically burning their files, Putin regards any democratic movements near or within Russia as a mortal threat. His deepest fear is that the spread of democracy and Western influence to Ukraine will mean that one day pro-democracy activists of the kind he saw in Dresden might come for him too. At the very least, Putin's newfound appetite for attention-grabbing military pressure signals his intent to upend Europe's post-Cold War security arrangements, said Anton Chernovsky in the New York Times. He wants a Russian sphere of influence in Eastern Europe, and even without actually invading Ukraine, he can use exercises of his nuclear force, cyber attacks, or future buildups to force previously unthinkable concessions from NATO. By maintaining the threat of the first large-scale land invasion in Europe since World War II, Putin could keep the crisis simmering for months or as long as it takes to get his way. GOP splits over defense of January 6 rioters. What happened? A major rift emerged this week within the GOP. After the Republican National Committee said the January 6 Capitol attackers were engaged in legitimate political discourse, prompting a strong denunciation from Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell and other influential GOP senators. In a declaration censuring Republicans Representatives Adam Kilzinger of Illinois and Liz Cheney of Wyoming for sitting on the House panel investigating the attack, the RNC called the probe a Democratic-led persecution of ordinary citizens. McConnell pushed back against sympathetic descriptions of the rioters, saying they took part in a violent insurrection seeking to overturn a legitimately certified election. GOP Senators Mitt Romney of Utah, Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, and Susan Collins of Maine also rebuked the RNC, with Collins calling its defense of the attackers absurd. RNC Chair Ronna McDaniel scrambled to smooth things over within the party, claiming the statement was only referring to protesters who had nothing to do with violence at the Capitol. Many allies of former President Trump, who has been increasingly at odds with McConnell, and said recently that if he returns to the White House, he'll consider pardoning supporters charged in connection with the attack, defended the RNC. But intra-party squabble highlighted the GOP's dilemma on how to discuss January 6 in the year's midterm elections. From my front row seat, Mark Short, former Vice President Mike Pence's former chief of staff, said, I did not see a lot of legitimate political discourse. What the columnist said. The GOP has become the January 6 party, said Max Boot in the Washington Post. Even after hearing Trumpist hail the Capitol attackers as patriotic heroes, it's still shocking to see the party adopt that as its official position. Legitimate political discourse, in the GOP's eyes, evidently describes an insurrection that left 140 police officers injured and Officer Brian Sicknick dead, and preceded the death by suicide of at least four other officers. Drawing attention to all this ahead of the midterms takes staggering stupidity from GOP leaders, said Noah Rothman in commentary. Defending the January 6 rioters just squanders the advantages Republicans are seeing in the polls. A recent survey found that about a quarter of Republican voters approve of the rioters' actions. While that's an unnervingly substantial number, it still leaves three-quarters of Republicans disapproving. Why split the party over this, aside from wanting to pander to Trump? There's a reason Trump's allies want to discredit the House probe, said Michael Schmidt and Luke Broadwater in the New York Times. It has brought in more than a dozen former federal prosecutors who are using tactics typically used against mobsters and terrorists to break through the stonewalling from Trump's camp. The panel has already turned at least six low-level former Trump staffers into witnesses. The end game is finding enough damning evidence to compel charges against those who organized and incited the attack, potentially including Trump himself. And our controversy of the week, as seen in the cover drawing. Football. Is the NFL rife with racism? Growing up poor and black in a rough part of New York City, Brian Flores says he was often stopped by police because I fit a description. The question is now whether he's out of a job as a head football coach for a similar reason, said Jeray Longman and Jenny Vrentas in the New York Times. Last week, Flores, now 40, filed a blockbuster class action lawsuit accusing the National Football League and its 32 teams of systemic racism in their hiring practices for head coaches. Flores was recently fired as the Miami Dolphins head coach despite a winning record this season, and was passed over for the New York Giants head coach job and other vacancies. Under the so-called Rooney Rule adopted in 2003, NFL teams must interview at least two external minority candidates for every head coaching job. Flores was interviewed by the Giants, but the interview was a cynical sham to satisfy the Rooney Rule, Flores said, citing an incriminating text he received indicating the Giants had decided to hire a white candidate 3 days before Flores could make his case. Proving deliberate discrimination will be difficult, said Bethany Lucina in the Washington Post, but the statistics are fairly incriminating. About 70% of NFL players are black, but as of this week, when two persons of color were conveniently hired, only three of the 32 head coaches are black. The NFL needs more black coaches, but Flores' lawsuit is 90% equine excrement, said Zachary Faria in Washington Examiner. He provides no concrete evidence of racism, and white coaches get fired all the time for the same reason Flores reportedly was: the reputation of being difficult and abrasive with players, other coaches, and team officials. The NFL had eight black head coaches as recently as 2017, said Jason Riley in the Wall Street Journal. Maybe that's not enough, but it does rather undermine the charge of league-wide racism. By suing the league and creating a public sensation, Flores may actually sabotage his own cause. Why would teams want to hire someone they can't fire without being labeled racist? Team ownership is the root of the problem, said John Devine in the Miami Herald. While the number of black coaches may be dismal, the number of black NFL owners is, well, zero. Indeed, of the 110 people who have ever owned a controlling interest in an NFL team, only two have been non-white. Most of the owners are male billionaires over 60, and they generally hire people they feel comfortable with. It would be foolish to expect real change until the NFL insists on some minority ownership. The NFL's problem is not intentional racism, said David French in The Atlantic, but it's good old boy network. The league's management and ownership are very much a clubby family affair, with 11 of 32 head coaches actually related to a former or current head coach, and 25% of offensive and defensive coordinators related to former or current head coaches. In an atmosphere of nepotism and so-called coaching trees that go back decades, black coaches are at a big disadvantage. If the NFL is serious about giving more black coaches the chances they so richly deserve, it must expand its circle to include more black general managers and, yes, owners. Flores' lawsuit has already had an impact, said Jamel Hill, also in The Atlantic. Commissioner Roger Goodell said the NFL would seize the opportunity to become a stronger, more inclusive league. Admitting that there's a problem is a first step. And it's time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. It was a good week for leverage. After the fired CNN anchor Chris Cuomo reportedly plans to demand that the Embattled Network pay him Megyn Kelly money, or about $60 million, for allegedly ruining his career. It was a good week for bookies. After the American Gaming Association estimated that a record 31.5 million Americans will wager $7.6 billion on the Super Bowl through licensed sportbooks, office pools, bets with friends, and illegal bookmakers. And it was a good week for Jonathan, a giant tortoise on the island of St. Helena, whom Guinness World Records this week recognized as the planet's oldest Chelonian, a category covering all turtles and tortoises. Jonathan, whose estimated age is 190, is bisexual and still regularly carries on with both a female and a male tortoise. But it was a bad week for Bruce Willis. With the unveiling of the nominees for this year's annual Razzie Awards, which recognize dubious achievements in film. Willis, 64, was honored with 8 nominations, all in the category Worst Performance by Bruce Willis in a 2021 movie. It was a bad week for fun, with an edict from Afghanistan's ruling Taliban that their fighters can no longer carry machine guns and other firearms when visiting the country's amusement parks, since it unnerves other visitors. And finally, it was a bad week for sins of the flesh when Eric Adams, New York City's new mayor, was forced to qualify his own frequent claims that he subsists on a plant-based diet. Responding to witness reports from restaurant goers, Adams admitted that, "I am perfectly imperfect and have occasionally eaten fish." Here's a short and other news piece on the page. USPS overhaul wins bipartisan backing. The House this week passed the most significant financial overhaul of the Postal Service in 20 years, relieving the agency of tens of billions of dollars in liabilities while establishing new requirements for timely delivery 6 days a week. The bill, which is expected to pass the Senate, would eliminate a 2006 requirement that the USPS prepay its retirees' health care costs. Instead, future postal retirees would be required to enroll in Medicare. Eliminating the 2006 rule is expected to save the USPS $50 billion over a decade. The bill is a victory for Postmaster General Louis DeJoy and was passed without provisions demanded by some Democrats for mail-in voting protections and funding to replace mail trucks with electric vehicles. The briefing this week is titled, Starting the Steal. Election integrity watchdogs are sounding the alarm as Trump allies take control of swing states' election machinery. What is the concern? Acolytes of Donald Trump, galvanized by his false claims of voter fraud, are laying the groundwork for overturning future elections by commandeering state and county election systems. A major reason Trump failed in his efforts to overturn the 2020 election is that state and local election officials, many of them Republicans, certified the results over Trump's objections and threats. In response, Trump allies such as far-right nativist Steve Bannon have launched a campaign to replace principled officials with Trump allies, from the lowest county volunteer up to the state's top election officials. Next time, the battered guardrails that held firm in 2020 might be gone, said Wendy Weiser of the Brennan Center for Justice. This is a giant crisis, she said. We've never seen anything like that before. How are Trump's allies doing this? The most visible effort is being made by scores of Stop the Stealers who are running to be secretaries of state. In most states, the top election official. An NPR analysis counts at least 20 current Republican Secretary of State candidates who question the legitimacy of the 2020 election, running in 17 states. In Georgia, Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger, who famously resisted Trump's entreaties to find 11,780 Trump votes, is being challenged by Jody Heiss, a Trump-endorsed congressman who opposed certifying the 2020 vote. In Michigan, among those running is the Republican primary, is Christina Caramo, a community college professor who has called the January 6 uprising a false flag operation by leftists and says Democrats are following a Satanist agenda. Running in Arizona is Mark Fincham, a member of the Oath Keepers militia, who was present at the Capitol insurrection and has links to QAnon. There's a lot of crazy going around, said Trey Grayson, a Republican former Secretary of State in Kentucky. You have people running for these offices where the most important duty is counting the votes and accepting the results, even if you don't like the outcome. And these folks don't appear to be well positioned to do that. There are also efforts to replace lower level elections officials. Where is that happening? Across numerous battleground states at every level. In Michigan, the state Republican Party replaced Aaron von Langeveld, a member of the state board of canvassers, who cast a decisive vote to certify the state's election results in favor of Biden. In 8 of the state's largest counties, Republicans have replaced members of the boards of canvassers who certify results with Trump partisans. They're laying the groundwork for a slow-motion insurrection, said local Democratic election lawyer Mark Brewer. In Horry County, South Carolina, a longtime Republican election official, Mike Kinnett, lost his position after an unprecedented crush of citizens showed up for a county convention and elected a QAnon supporter. In Pennsylvania, hundreds of Trump supporters recruited by Stop the Steal groups won county election inspector positions in November, some through write-in campaigns. There and in many other states, Trump-linked newcomers are filling positions vacated by veteran officials who are walking away after being inundated with threats and harassment. Officials in many counties say they've been deluged with Trump loyalists volunteering to serve as precinct officers, many of them rallied by Bannon. In some states, proposed new laws might help them contest or overturn any results they don't like. What would those laws do? They'd give state legislatures unprecedented power to exert control over local election boards and the certification of results. At least 148 such bills were introduced in 36 states last year, according to a report by three nonpartisan watchdog groups called A Democracy Crisis in the Making. Bills were proposed in seven states, including Arizona, Missouri, and Nevada, that would have given legislatures the power to change or overturn election results. "We are at code red," said Jenna Griswold, Colorado's Democratic Secretary of State. "We are seeing a coordinated effort by extreme Republicans to undo American democracy." Much of this legislation has not yet passed, but three states have enacted laws giving partisan legislators pathways to control county election administration. They include Georgia, which passed a sweeping election bill last March. It allows a state board appointed by the Republican legislature to take control of county vote tallying and to replace a local board with a hand-picked administrator who could invalidate ballots. What can be done? Election integrity experts say federal legislation is needed that would restrict a state's legislature's ability to insert itself into election administration or vote certification. But Senate Republicans oppose federal rules over how states run elections. That leaves one realistic strategy for those opposed to the MAGA organizing campaign, a counter-movement of principled Republicans and Democrats to prevent a Trumpist takeover of election machinery. Bannon, meanwhile, crows that Trump populists are making great inroads. "It's about winning elections with the right people, MAGA people," he said. "We will have our people in at every level." Bannon's volunteer army. For Rick Barnes, the Republican Party chair in Texas Tarrant County, the barrage of calls was baffling. People were suddenly clamoring to know how they could become volunteer precinct officers, a low-level role that's never drawn much interest. The reason, Barnes soon learned, was Steve Bannon. On his popular War Room podcast, the former Trump advisor had issued a call to action beseeching Trump supporters to volunteer at local election boards, part of a precinct strategy aimed at taking the reins of election administration village by village. Bannon's effort has yielded big dividends. When ProPublica reached out to Republican leaders in 65 counties, 41 reported an unprecedented surge in volunteers, one unmatched on the Democratic side. "People are coming out of the woodwork," said Polk County, Florida Party Chair J.C. Martin. "Their motivation is simple," said Palm Beach County GOP Chair Michael Barnett, who's seen a similar surge. "They feel Trump was defrauded of his rightful win and that their involvement in upcoming elections will prevent something like that from happening again." And we're up to the best columns of the week. We'll start with two from the U.S. A reality check for unions. "So much for the dramatic comeback of labor unions," said Jeff Jacoby. Much was made last year of a Gallup poll showing that Americans' support for unions had climbed to 68%, the highest level since 1965. Dozens of strikes seemed to suggest the tight labor market was giving unions greater leverage. But while pro-union liberals enthusiastically pointed out the trees, they entirely missed the forest. Union membership fell by 250,000 workers last year. Just 14 million Americans belong to unions by year's end, continuing a 40-year decline. Most people approve of unions only in the abstract. Personally, they're more likely to take jobs in right-to-work states that prohibit employers from forcing workers to pay union dues. But while private sector unions are withering, 33.9% of public sector employees are unionized. It's easy to see why. At private companies, unions and management contend for a share of profits. In the public sector, there are no profits to share, only taxpayer dollars, which Democratic politicians happily dole out in return for labor support and votes. Even when the pay, perks, and pensions of public workers send budgets through the roof, what choice do taxpayers have but to foot the bill? No black woman is qualified? Conservatives are playing with racial fire by discrediting the Supreme Court's first black female justice before she is even nominated, said Juan Williams. Soon after President Biden confirmed his intent to nominate a black woman to replace the retiring Stephen Breyer, several Republican senators predicted she'll be undeserving. Mississippi Senator Roger Wicker said a black woman nominee would be the beneficiary of affirmative racial discrimination, while Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri derided Biden's goal of adding gender and racial diversity to the court as woke and race-obsessed. Race-obsessed? The 115 justices who have served on the Supreme Court have included only two black people and no black women. Have qualified black judges and lawyers been overlooked by presidents such as Donald Trump, whose three court nominees were all white and whose federal judicial appointments were overwhelmingly white and male? Among Biden's potential Supreme Court nominees are federal judges Ketanji Brown Jackson and J. Michelle Childs, who have more distinguished legal resumes than most of the sitting justices. Is this dangerous time in America race relations a Republican preemptive libel that no black woman could possibly be qualified for the Supreme Court will be a deep and unforgettable insult? This comes from Canada. Under siege by Freedom Convoy. It feels like something broke in Canada, said Robin Sears in the Toronto Star. A convoy of truckers protesting vaccine mandates set up camp in Ottawa last week, drawing thousands of supporters in a raucous occupation of downtown. Business in the nation's capital has ground to a halt, and Ottawa has declared a state of emergency. This is no peaceful protest. Drunken rioters have left their feces on residents' front doors, shot fireworks amid buildings, and urinated on sidewalks from atop their trucks. Alongside signs protesting COVID rules, flutter Trump flags, as well as swastikas and other hate symbols. And while police have made a few arrests, they can't clear the roads. Clearly, we are outnumbered and we are losing this battle, said Ottawa Mayor Jim Watson. Canada, which has always been a little too smug about its values of civility and respect, is in shock. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau condemned the hateful displays and told the truckers to go home. But organizers insist they will stay until vaccine mandates are repealed. Trudeau won't say it out loud, but only the military, not the police, can overwhelm massed groups of enormous trucks and end this occupation and the unbearable honking. Canada is under siege by a well-funded assault on democracy, said Omar Aziz in the Globe and Mail. Just as with the January 6th Capitol insurrection in the U.S., we are witnessing an attempt to alter government policy by force, masquerading as a rally for freedom. Notice that South Asian drivers, who make up about one-fifth of all Canadian truckers, are not taking part. That's because this movement has been seized by white nationalists and their far-right allies. Police say much of the funding for the truckers is actually coming from the U.S. It's utterly unfair to condemn all the protesters as extremists, said Lori Goldstein in the Toronto Sun. Opposition to vaccine mandates is perfectly reasonable. After all, before the mandate, truckers were allowed to submit negative COVID tests in lieu of vaccination cards. But rather than listening to their grievances, Trudeau has angrily stereotyped the demonstrators as white supremacists, misogynists, and lawbreakers. Sorry, but I'm tired of the same old few bad apples analogies, said Sri Paradkar in the Toronto Star. We knew this was a convoy of hatred from the moment we saw the first swastika. And the longer the protest drags on, the more these toxic symbols become normalized. Yet Canadian conservatives have embraced the rally, said Justin Ling in Maclean's. Interim Conservative Party leader Candace Bergen actually said there were good people on both sides, echoing Donald Trump. Her party bigwigs, meanwhile, are playing a furious game of Frogger, gleefully glad-handing demonstrators while carefully avoiding being photographed with Confederate flags or signs reading "Vaccines equal genocide" or "Trudeau for Gitmo." Canada's right is eager to tap into this raw populist energy to win right-wing votes, and that's worrying. When leaders lend credibility to wacky views, it only entrenches these paranoid delusions. The truckers have now dug in, and they'll be extremely hard to dislodge. The last word, our feature article this week, goes in a little different direction from the current news. It's titled, "The Worst Restaurant Meal Ever." At a Michelin-starred eatery in Italy, said Geraldine DeReuter in Everywhereist.com, we were served 27 courses with rancid ricotta, three noodles, and citrus foam, but nothing resembling actual food. There is something to be said about a truly disastrous meal, a meal forever indelible in your memory because it's so uniquely bad, it can only be deemed an achievement. The sort of meal where everyone involved was definitely trying to do something, it's just not entirely clear what. I'm not talking about a meal that's poorly cooked or a server who might be planning your murder. That sort of thing happens in the fat lump of the bell curve of bad. Instead, I'm talking about the long tail stuff, the sort of meals that make you feel as though the fabric of reality is unraveling, the ones that cause you to reassess the fundamentals of capitalism and whether or not you're living in a simulation in which someone failed to properly program this particular restaurant. The ones where you just know somebody's going to lift a metal dome off a tray and reveal a single blue or red pill. I'm talking about those meals. At some point, the only way to regard that sort of experience without going mad is as some sort of community improv theater. You sit in the audience shouting suggestions like a restaurant and eating something that resembles food, and the exchange of money for goods, and in this instance, the goods are a gosh darn meal. All of these suggestions go completely ignored. That is how I've come to regard our dinner at Bro's, the only Michelin-starred restaurant in the Italian city of Lecce, as a means of preserving what's left of my sanity. It wasn't dinner. It was just dinner theater. No, scratch that, because dinner was not involved. I mean, dinner played a role the same way Godot played a role in Beckett's play. The entire evening was about it, and guess what? It never showed. So no, we can't call it dinner theater. Instead, we'll say it was just theater. Very, very expensive theater. I realize that not everyone is willing or able to afford a ticket to Waiting for Godot, and so this post exists to spare you our torment. We headed to the restaurant with high hopes, eight of us in total, led into a cement cell of a room, Drake pumping through invisible speakers. It was sweltering hot, and no other customers were present. The decor had the chicness of an underground bunker where one would expect to be interrogated for the disappearance of an ambassador's child. Earlier that day, we'd seen a sculpture of a bear, chiseled into marble centuries ago, by someone who had clearly never actually seen a bear. That's a perfect allegory for our evening. It's as though someone had read about food and restaurants, but had never experienced either, and this was their attempt to recreate them. What followed our entrance into the restaurant was a 27-course meal. Note that course and meal and 27 are being used liberally here. That spanned 4.5 hours and made me feel like I was a character in a Dickensian novel. Because, I cannot impart this enough, there was nothing even close to an actual meal served. Some courses were slivers of edible paper. Some shots were glasses of vinegar. Everything tasted like fish, even the non-fish courses. And nearly everything, including three noodles, which was by far the most substantial dish we had, was served cold. Amassing 2 dozen of them together amounted to a meal the same way amassing 2 dozen toddlers together amounts to one middle-aged adult. I've checked TripAdvisor. Other people who've eaten at Bros were served food. Some of them got meat and ravioli and more than one slice of bread. Some of them were served things that needed to be eaten with forks and spoons. We got a tablespoon of crab. I've tried to come up with hypotheses for what happened. Maybe the staff just ran out of food that night. Maybe they confused our table with that of their ex-lovers. Maybe they were drunk. But we got 12 kinds of foam, something I can only describe as an oyster loaf that tasted like Newark Airport, and a teaspoon of savory ice cream that was olive-flavored. I'm still not over that, to be honest. I thought it was going to be pistachio. There is no menu at Bros, just a blank newspaper with a QR code linking to a video featuring one of the chefs, presumably against a black background, talking directly into the camera about things entirely unrelated to food. He occasionally uses the proper noun of the restaurant as an adverb, the way a Smurf would. This means that you can't order anything besides the tasting menu, but also that you are at the mercy of the servers to explain to you what the hell is going on. The servers will not explain to you what the hell is going on. They will not do this in Italian. They will not do this in English. They will not play Pictionary with you on the blank newspaper as a means of communicating what you are eating. On the rare occasions when they did offer an explanation for a dish, it did not help. These are made with rancid ricotta, the server said, placing a tiny fried cheese ball in front of each of us. I'm sorry, did you say rancid? You mean fermented, aged? No, rancid. Okay, I said in Italian, but I think that something might be lost in translation, because it can't be. Rancido, he clarified. Another course, a citrus foam, was served in a plaster cast of the chef's mouth. Absent utensils, we were told to lick it out of the chef's mouth in a scene that I'm pretty sure was stolen from an Eastern European horror film. Incredibly, this item is available for sale at their gift shop. In case you want to have a restraining order filed against you this holiday season. Now, at this point, I may have started quietly freaking out. A hierarchical pecking order was being established, and when you're the one desperately slurping sustenance out of the plaster cast of someone else's mouth, it's safe to say you are at the bottom of that pyramid. We'd been beaten into some sort of weird psychological submission, like the Stanford prison experiment, but with less prison and more aspic. That's the only reason I have for why we didn't leave during any of these incidents. When a member of our party stood up during a lengthy stretch between courses to go have a cigarette outside and was scolded to sit down. When one member of our party was served nothing for three consecutive courses because they couldn't figure out how to accommodate her food allergies. When my husband, Rand, was served food he was allergic to repeatedly because they didn't care enough to accommodate his. When a server reprimanded me for eating the reconstituted orange slices, one per person, that were served to us as a course. I asked if I could eat the real orange that had been served alongside it. We'd all gotten one, and I, at this point, was extremely hungry. Yes, the server said, annoyed, but you aren't really supposed to. He let me have two segments and then whisked the fruit away. We kept waiting for someone to bring us something, anything that resembled dinner, until the exact moment when we realized it would never come. It was when our friend Lisa tried to order another bottle of wine. "Would you like red or white?" the server asked. "What are we having for the main?" she inquired. His face blanched. "The main, madame? We're about to move on to dessert." We sat for a moment, letting this truth settle over us. Because by now it had been hours, and at no point had we been served anything that could be considered dinner. There was one time when I thought it might happen. The staff placed dishes in front of us and then swirled sauces on the dishes, and I clapped my hands, excitedly waiting for something to be plated atop those beautiful sauces. Instead, someone came by with an eyedropper and squirted drops of gelée onto our plates. "We've infused these droplets with meat molecules," the server explained, and left. I don't know if our experience was the norm. I'd looked at TripAdvisor's photo for Bros, and other people who have gone there seem to have been fed actual food. Even the person at another table who was served the same weird meat droplet course at least got it with a triangle of foamy-looking bread. Do you know what it's like to envy someone for a piece of foamy-looking bread? It's not great. "There's no main," Lisa said to us in disbelief after the server had retreated. "Hey," I said, my hand resting on her arm. She was shaking slightly from low blood sugar. "It's okay." "They haven't effing fed us," she said, her eyes wide. I know, I said, "but look, we're in this amazing country, and I don't know about you, but nothing is going to stop me from enjoying tonight." She nodded. "Because I'm surrounded by my favorite people," I said, and I squeezed Lisa's hand for emphasis, "and I'm at my favorite restaurant." Lisa sputtered, laughing. No more food was coming, but there was something freeing in that. Because this meal had never been about us to begin with, it sure as hell wasn't about the food, and there is something glorious about finally giving up. We sat through a few more courses, including a marshmallow flavored like cuttlefish, and a dish called frozen air that literally melted before you could eat it, which felt like a metaphor for the night. And then someone came in and demanded we stand and exit the restaurant. Thinking we were getting kicked out, we gleefully followed. Instead, we were led across the street to a dark doorway and into the Bros laboratory. A video of the shirtless kitchen staff doing extreme sports played on a large screen TV, while a chef cut us comically tiny slivers of fake cheese. Rand was, of course, allergic to it. The bill arrived. The meal cost more than any other we'd eat during our trip by a magnitude of 3. They'd given us balloons with the restaurant's name across it, and the chef emerged and insisted on posing with us for a Polaroid that we did not ask for. We were finally released into the night, after every other restaurant had closed, ensuring that no food would be consumed that evening. That was abhorrent, we all agreed, as we shoved the balloons into a dumpster. I'd made everyone take one with the baffling logic that they'd know that they'd somehow help offset the cost of the meal. We howled at how ridiculous it was and how they'd poisoned Rand, how maybe we should have known that a restaurant named Bros was going to be a disaster. It was like an awful show that we had front row tickets to. But wasn't there something glorious about sharing it together? The way that a terrible experience makes you all closer? No, someone said, and we laughed even harder. P.S. The next day, one of the staff tried contacting the only single female member of our party via Instagram messages. "Hey, I served you last night," he wrote. She immediately blocked him. This story was originally published in everywhereist.com. Here's a couple of health and science pieces. Exercise and sexual health. Everyone knows exercise is good for physical health, but there is mounting evidence that it is also crucial for your sexual health. Exercise improves your blood circulation, which is key to erections in men and sexual sensation in women. Previous studies have shown that men with a high waist circumference, or BMI, are 50% more likely to suffer from erectile dysfunction, and that roughly half of obese women experience problems with sexual activity, desire, and performance. In contrast, more recent research shows that a woman who exercise for 6 hours a week have lower sexual distress and resistance in their clitoral arteries, and much higher levels of desire, arousal, and orgasm. This is important, researchers say, because sexual activity has a significant impact on mental and emotional health. This is truly a medical issue we should be dealing with as part of someone's overall health and well-being, Karen Elber, a sexual wellness expert at Los Angeles Cedars-Sinai Medical Center, tells CNN. But there's still a stigma around the topic. Methane leaks from gas stoves. Gas stoves leak significant amounts of methane, even when they're turned off, a new study has found. Researchers from Stanford University measured emissions of the greenhouse gas from ovens and broilers in 53 homes in California. They found that as much as 1.3% of the gas the appliances use leaks into the atmosphere. Some methane escapes during the brief seconds after the pilot light kicks in. Stoves with automatic sparkers were slightly faster, and some during cooking. But about 80% of the leakage takes place when the stoves are off, presumably because of loosed couplings and fittings on the pipes. Simply owning a natural gas stove and having natural gas pipes and fittings in your home leads to more emissions over 24 hours than the amount emitted while the burners are on, co-author Rob Jackson tells NPR.org. Interestingly, the age or cost of the stove made no difference in emissions levels. While methane doesn't linger in the atmosphere as long as carbon dioxide, it is a more potent greenhouse gas. The researchers estimate that the leaks from the roughly 40 million gas stoves in the U.S. have the same planet-warming effect as the emissions from 500,000 gas-powered cars. And we've just time for some short pieces on the Talking Points page. Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch gave a speech last week to the Federalist Society, a conservative legal group which was closed to the press. The conference also included speeches from Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and former Vice President Mike Pence, and a panel discussion entitled "The End of Roe v. Wade." The nearly 16 million viewers of the opening ceremony of the Beijing Winter Olympics represented a 43% drop from the viewership for the kickoff of the last Winter Games in South Korea. On the poll watch, Americans are split into several camps on how the U.S. should respond to COVID at this time. 21% said the country should open up and get back to life as usual with no mandates or requirements, while 29% want to move toward opening up with precautions. 23% prefer to mostly keep precautions and requirements in place, and 21% want to increase mask mandates and vaccine requirements. And we've finish out with a quote. This is from Joanne Woodward, quoted in Brides. And I believe her husband was Paul Newman. At any rate, the quote is, "Sexiness wears thin after a while and beauty fades. But to be married to a man who makes you laugh every day, ah, now that's a real treat." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten by the law firm of W.G. Alexander & Associates. Alexander attorneys provide top-rated and experienced legal counsel concentrating on estate planning, elder law, special needs, and asset protection. Call W.G. Alexander & Associates at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.